Greetings, Raise community, and welcome to today's episode of the Raise podcast, coming in live with the first episode that I am recording in 2024. Does that mean it's the first episode that we will publish? I don't know or make all of those decisions, but full transparency, first one, so revving up the engine. And I'm thrilled to welcome Roger Devine, who serves as Assistant Vice President for Advancement Operations at Pomona College. Welcome, Roger.
Thank you, Brent, for the warm introduction. Great to be here.
Well, we are going to try to shine a light on the advancement operations world a bit more in 2024. There's so much happening in the context of the future of CRM and AI and what the tech stack of tomorrow is going to look like. And so we are excited to be able to start that conversation with you, but we're not going to dive right into all that. I want to know more about who you are. Roger, tell me more about, let's say, junior year of high school. Who is that, Roger? What was he into? What led you to the University of Michigan to study Espanol and Japanese?
Oh, wow. Great. Junior year of high school, I was a curious cat. I was absorbing myself in foreign language. I was studying Spanish and enjoying it quite a bit. I was taking a heavy course load, thinking about college. I had just come back from a cultural exchange program in Spain called Nacelle. And I lived on a farm with the family over that summer.
Where?
Previous summer.
Give me a dot on the map. Where are we talking about in Spain? I love it.
Okay. So if you fly into Madrid and you take a bus, like 10 hours driving up north, I stayed in a small town with a host family. The town was called Guipúzcoa, and it's near Bilbao, like the Running of the Bulls. You hear about that. And the family had bee farms and all of that. So very much in the north of Spain in the Basque region.
And how old were you? How old were you?
I was just turned 16.
Unbelievable. I mean, what an adventure. And did you actually have to take the bus 10 hours from Madrid?
Yeah, I flew into Madrid and got on this bus. It was a guided program. And when I arrived, the host family, nobody spoke any English. It was all Spanish and Basque. And I had my Spanish dictionary, and it was full on immersion. And I was kind of a bookworm a little bit. I was really into electronic music. I had a classical music background. But in Spain, I really embraced this new culture, trying to assimilate this language. And I was riding on the back of motorcycles, doing all kinds of things that I would not normally do. And I really credit that experience of being in an immersive language and cultural environment, so different than my home base, that it really expanded my mindset. And so that's really the link to later pursuing.
So we're not going to go to college yet because I'm too fascinated. Okay. So you're in, you're outside of Bilbao. First of all, what's one or two things everybody should know about Bilbao, but probably don't?
The people so welcome and embrace attempts to connect through language. If you even just say, hello, how are you, in broken Spanish, soon people will be bringing you coffee or water and Spanish tortillas and food. The other thing is the siesta. You might have heard about, people waking up and drinking coffee with chocolate and these pastries. That's true. That happened. churros y chocolate. And then everything shuts down in the afternoon, 2 to 4 o'clock siesta. And we would eat dinner at like 9 to 10 o'clock at night. So that was just that schedule alone was really disorienting, but exciting.
Amazing. And so what was your level of Spanish proficiency when you got there relative to when you left? How much time did you spend there?
Oh, that's a great question. My proficiency, I studied maybe 4 years of Spanish before the exchange program. I stayed there for a little over a month. And by the time I left, my Spanish had improved greatly because I was forced to practice. I had the Spanish dictionary. No one spoke English. and very few people spoke English, and so it was a forcing function. Just by being in that environment and hearing Spanish, I was using Spanish, and so my confidence in speaking Spanish jumped. And when I returned back to the States, I kept on studying. And in language proficiency, we talk about competency. There's passive competency, and then there's the actual act of speaking. So you can be very familiar with the language, but until you use it, it's a different muscle, so to speak. And that paradigm has played out for a lot of learning new skills in my career path. So I really credit foreign language and music with helping me having this kind of growth learning mindset.
I love it. All right, let's go to the University of Michigan. By the way, where were you in the US prior to going to Spain? Where'd you grow up?
Oh yeah, I was born in Detroit, Michigan, and I grew up in the Midwest. And I went to middle school, high school in Troy, Michigan, and went to University of Michigan in Ann Arbor, which is in southeast Michigan. People from Michigan show you the hand always back there. Yeah, good old southeastern Michigan.
I'm from Iowa, and it just isn't the same when you just hand. I mean, it should be kind of, and I could be like, I'm from here, but yeah, not a thing. Okay, so you kind of get hooked on language. You go to Michigan, you continue to study language. Are you pursuing music academically as well?
Actually, I started at University of Michigan in computer engineering. So that was my major for 2 years. And at that time, I'm dating myself because this was before computer science was a full-blown major, its own separate major. If you wanted to do something with computers back when I was an undergrad, it was computer science and engineering. And I took the coursework. A lot of it was, discrete math, a lot of calculus, computer science foundations. But then a lot of it was like embedded programming, like on hardware. And I had no interest in building computer chips. So I left the College of Engineering and went to the Literature, Science, and Arts, LSNA. And I kept taking Spanish because I just loved it so much. Japanese came later, which is a different story, but
And so that is a fun pivot in that I also studied Spanish, Portuguese, and Italian, sort of vagabonding my way through the international relations curriculum. And on one hand, it can sort of open up a world of possibilities. On the other hand, it is not particularly great at helping one focus. And so, how did you sort of think about, language study, which can be really fun, also a great way to meet people, because especially if you're used to bigger classes, they tend to be smaller, they tend to be highly conversational. Like, was that your experience? But ultimately, where did you see it going? I'm guessing it wasn't to lead advancement operations someday.
No, actually, my dad was always encouraging me to go into business. He knew I had a knack for computers, so he said maybe IT. So that seed was planted. I actually later matriculated into the School of Education because I thought maybe I would be a teacher or even maybe a Spanish literature professor one day. So I was toying with that. I was a super senior, so it took me 5 years to finish undergrad because I had so many interests. So the my college roommate spoke Japanese and said, "Hey, there's this immersive 10-week, 10-credit Japanese program. I think you might want to check it out. Spanish and Japanese have the same phonetics, so I think you'd do well." So, on a leap of faith, I took this immersion Japanese course over that summer and ended up liking the language a lot. And and I was taking computer science courses as well. So everything around language, music, human language, computer language, I think I'm just wired for language. And
I
full
love it.
disclosure, I grew up in a bilingual household because my mom is from Korea. And so I was exposed to multiple languages from an early age. So,
And so how do you start shaping all of that into a first job?
great. My dad got me a book called Resumes That Knock 'Em Dead. And so I read the books and I started applying to jobs and talking around. I went to some job fairs and I was thinking about grad school. And I worked all through undergrad in as a resident systems computing consultant and project staff. I helped with orientation. So I was familiar working in an office environment on projects. And I was a help desk caller for like network operations in the dorms. So I would say that IT, the door to information technology was kind of the first door that I stepped in and I got a taste of working life. And upon graduation, I just started sending out application letters or responding to job things. But it was really through word of mouth because I was not getting very far with the kind of cold call resume blast. And the strength of weak social ties, right? So a friend of a friend said, "Hey, there's some job over here. You might want to check this out. They're hiring 40 hours a week." So I joined University of Michigan Central Information Technology Division. And the rest is that was the beginning of my IT career. Yeah.
Love it. So, just to be quick update, I am stunned at the reviews on Amazon for Resumes That Knock 'Em Dead by Martin Yates. So, Martin, if you're listening, great work. 65% of the reviews are, in fact, 5 stars and some really passionate responses. So, that in part leads you to the networked search, if you will, at the alma mater. And so you're at sort of an interesting time where the internet is rapidly advancing. I'm sure it was a very intense period of change and transformation, especially at an enterprise like the University of Michigan. And it really I mean, you were able to build a real career out of that kind of accidental start, if you will. But when did it start? When did the business of advancement get on your radar while you're at Michigan? Obviously, you're an alum, so you're getting your appeals and you're going to, the tailgates or whatever is happening. But when did you start understanding that aspect of the enterprise? Because a lot of people, that we've interviewed, it was the student caller or they became a student leader. They got kind of pulled in and recruited, where you sort of took maybe the side door.
So, great question. While working full time, I was working doing infrastructure operations, IT operations, and some software engineering, accounting software. And I went back to graduate school at University of Michigan School of Information, and I did their info analysis retrieval master's science and information because I wanted to learn how to build search engines. They said, "Oh, if you have a background in foreign language, maybe you could be a language engineer, work at Google, Microsoft." So upon completing that degree, which I finished part-time while working full-time in IT, I was working for a lot of different hats, but there was a analytics leadership position at the Ross School of Business Development and Alumni Relations team. It was an inaugural position, and I saw analytics in the title, so I threw my hat in the ring. A friend, I think, had maybe passed the position and said, "Oh yeah, didn't you do your, master's in data analytics? Like, there's an analytics position at the business school. You should check it out." So I crafted my cover letter, my resume, updated my resume, and I submitted. I didn't know anybody. It was cold. It was the business school. And I was just, thinking about my dad in the back of my mind, "Oh, one day you should go into business, language and computer or something." So I didn't know anything about advancement. It was a development alumni relations position on their leadership team, and they needed someone who could do Tableau and build dashboards and familiarity with the financial systems and the advancement. And I think, and I had built some dashboards in Tableau and so forth prior to that role. So without knowing anybody on that team, I got the job. So I started their analytics lead in 2013. And quickly thereafter, I assumed responsibility for the annual giving program. So it was a crash course, full on immersion. And this is the theme of my life. I throw myself into the deep end and I just keep on swimming. So well, just like being in Spain, I'm in the business school. All of a sudden, I'm now wearing a suit and I am learning the language. Because whenever you learn a new domain, you have to learn all the jargon. So, okay.
Plenty of jargon in the annual giving. Back to
yes.
Like your first month there, your first 90 days. Mm-hmm. What was it intuitive? Did it feel super foreign? I mean, maybe somewhere in between.
Somewhere in between. My first assignment, the first 90 days, was laid out that I needed to get this pipeline stage forecast dashboard working, and I needed to fix a broken Tableau dashboard where leadership wanted to see in a single dashboard view pointing to two different data sources. One, see the advancement data, how much new production, new dollars and commitments, and then have a second part of the dashboard in the single view pointing to the finance system, showing the general ledger in financial operations. So I was comfortable with the data sourcing and pointing the Tableau to both of those points. But what was challenging was endowment, endowed funds, spendable. There was all these categorical groupings. And I had a crash course learn the language of all of these advancement financials very quickly. So it was a crash course. I was reading every book that I could get my hands on. I was talking to people on the finance team, talking, and we fixed the dashboard, got it done within 3 months. And I just kept growing and learning and doing.
And then, one of the things that stands out about this sector is that there are incredible peer support networks. I know that you've been involved with Meeting of the Minds, for example, that you've been involved with APRA. There's, Tableau specific communities that several of my colleagues have been a part of. And at the same time, you might not have known any of that existed. So were you able to tap into peer support, or were you sort of on an island at that point?
I did tap into peer support. One of the things about me is I am curious, and sometimes when you're faced with a problem, I shifted from thinking about what and how to who could help, who had a piece of the puzzle. It was like a big jigsaw puzzle. And so I called it WOTA Wednesdays, Wolverine Tower Wednesdays. I would just go and I would talk, I would ask around, oh, I'm working on this. This is what I'm trying to do. Do you know someone who could help? And I met some really great people along the way who said, oh yeah, we have a report that could maybe answer part of that question. Oh, you should talk to this person. And I would just keep snowballing. And I built out this network of subject matter experts and knowledge partners who could really help me along the way. So,
great book called Who Not How. If you haven't read it, I'm guessing you have others listening, you should. It's also one of those books that, you read the cover and that's pretty much the punchline of the whole book. But if you need more, then you can go and go through the process of reading. Definitely a good one that I come back to on a regular basis. And so at this point in the story, nothing you've told me indicates, you know what, maybe I should move to California. I mean, we are through and through childhood through, early career, mid-career, let's call it. And where did that come from?
I was working at the business school and running the annual giving program. And my former boss was recruited and landed at University of Southern California, I think in December of 2014, early 2015. And I was attending a research conference in California in early 2015. And I sent him an email saying, hey, I'm going to be in town for this conference. If you're around, maybe we could get together for coffee, just catch up. And he responded very quickly and said, oh, could you bring an updated copy of your resume? And one thing led to another. And, oh, could you clear, you know, an hour or two? Oh, there's some people I'd like you to meet. Oh, and he made me aware that there was an opportunity. He needed someone to run annual giving and build a data analytics program or department. And so I said, oh, that's really curious. I don't know. I'm really anchored in Michigan. I had a house and a cat, big piano, all this stuff. I was teaching yoga classes. I was deeply rooted in that community. And I talked to my kitchen cabinet, you know, of advisors, my best friends. I said, I don't know. It seems like California is knocking on the door. And they said, how many times in your life are you going to have California knocking on your door? In February of 2015, it was negative 20 degrees in Michigan, and it was 84 degrees in Southern California.
Nailed it. Yeah. Good timing.
Timing, the window. So it was a no-brainer. And I got an apartment. I put my house on the market. It sold in 3 days. Next thing I know, I'm moving and living, you know, moving across the country.
Here's the most amazing part of that story for me. And it's so simple. But why did you send the email in the first place? And what if you hadn't?
Oh.
Because my point is, it is amazing how many stories there are. And I think it applies to fundraising as well, where it was the fourth attempt instead of the third, or the first time that anybody had ever heard from somebody, or somebody had just been waiting, they'd just been doing their estate planning, and that outreach came at the right time. And that can be the difference between no philanthropy, for example, and millions of dollars of philanthropy. And it's like, it's just an email sometimes. Or in your case, it can be the difference between continue to build your life with your cat and your piano and everything you know in the Michigan, or California. Now we're talking today. It's like, you know, how do you think about, I mean, was it random? Was it intentional? And I don't know, what perspective might you share for other people that would have gone on that same trip and maybe not done that outreach?
I think, you know, so much about success in life hinges on relationships, high quality interactions and relationships. And before my boss left, we had had coffee at Starbucks, and he said, I really enjoy working with you. You're really exceptional with computers and data. If we ever have the opportunity to reconnect in the future, I will let you know. And I think that the fact that he made time during his transition to me was really meant a lot to me, because he was really a great, so supportive, and he loved data and he loved Tableau and he loved reports. And I felt really appreciated with his vision and view and wanting to have data and decision support by his side. And that stuck in my head in that fall. So when the spring came, I was like, you know what? Who do I know in California? Oh, I remember that interaction and how he kind of left that door of communication open. And so just on instinct, the timing, it was like, I don't know anybody in California, but from here, I just wanted to send a note of congratulations and, you know, hopefully as well. And I think it was the strength of that relationship. We worked together a couple of years prior, and
a great filler visit.
Serendipity, you know, but I would say that chance does, an opportunity does favor the prepared, and it favors, you know, we often talk about an overnight sensation, but if you're doing the work and you you do your best and you make a positive impression on people because you, and you show up. So I think I worked really hard in that role, and I think that translated. And that turned into the next 6.5, almost 7 years of my tenure at University of Southern California, growing and learning and building.
What are you most proud of when you reflect on the time at USC? And then I want to make sure we carve out time, Mona.
What I'm most proud of in my time at USC was changing the culture within our business unit, and even some positive influence more broadly in the broader advancement committee, getting people to embrace using data and reports for decision support on a daily basis. When I first arrived, the questions were, is there a report I'm trying to do? I need a list, I need a list, I need a list. And by the time I left, it was, I'm planning a trip, I have an anchor visit, I want to do some discovery, and I'm working on this initiative. Can you help me prepare for my trip based on this defined opportunity in my portfolio? The questions shifted from so much more reactive to proactive and strategic. And a lot of the tools and processes and things are still in place and are being used. So I'm really proud. I'm most proud of leaders build other leaders. And so I'm really proud of the continued success of a lot of people who I worked with, and some of the gift opportunities, 3, 4, 5 years in the making, some of these larger transformative gifts, like naming of a department or faculty chairs, watching those things come to fruition through all of our hard work. It's a big deal to name a department or get these, larger principal or mega gifts. So I feel a sense of achievement and accomplishment looking back in the rearview mirror saying, look at that new building, look at those new faculty positions, look at this, department being named. It's a real privilege and honor to have been part of something so much bigger than myself, to help access an opportunity for students and scholarship. And philanthropy is a very noble calling. So I'm really energized and inspired by it.
Speaking of bigger, University of Michigan enrollment, 51,000, USC enrollment, 49,000, Pomona College enrollment, roughly 1,750, just to set some context for our listeners. And so that is, other than being in Southern California, not a ton in common. How did you hear about the opportunity, Pomona? What got you so excited about moving in that direction?
A search firm reached out and pinged me. I was finishing up my doctoral dissertation at USC in organizational change and leadership. I was wearing a lot of different hats in the external affairs realm. A recruiting firm had pinged me. Actually, a couple of recruiting firms had pinged me about some next leadership, exciting leadership opportunities. Geography was all over the place. And I just said, politely, this is not a good time, no thanks. 2 months later, I got another ping, we would really wonder if you just take a call, just hear us out, learn a little bit more about the position, and maybe you'd have some referrals for us. So I took a couple calls and I started these recruitment processes. I was finishing up, my dissertation, my final defense, and I started to think about next steps. Pomona College, when you choose a role, you choose a leader, and you're choosing a culture. The more I learned about Pomona College, I started to realize that, the small private liberal arts college, my own background in the languages, science, all of this stuff, Pomona College started to really resonate with me and its mission and the role itself too. My technology orientation, my love for data, throughout the rest of the recruitment process, it became really clear that my mission and values really aligned with the leadership of the institution. And I'm so grateful. And 2.5 years now, it's just flying by. But
Well, tell us what you're excited about. You've got some big projects underway, and certainly you highlighted it in some of the pre-interview questions that we discussed, and you know that we're equally excited about what the future of generative AI might hold for our sector as we really turn the corner here on 2024.
I'm really excited about our work with our conversion to Salesforce. But when I think about CRM, it's bigger than that. This is a true digital transformation. Our ecosystem is large. We have a lot of disparate moving pieces. And one of the things that excites me most is using technology to truly build a cohesive, well-integrated advancement program of excellence. Operations and infrastructure undergird that work. And at the end of the day, it's about connectivity with our alumni, our families, our friends, and inspiring them to learn and capture their imagination about the great vision of our institution. And I would say that being in a position to give shape and create this infrastructure is really, really exciting. I've jumped into many shops. You always have technical debt. You have, and one thing I've learned, just because it's a small private liberal arts college does not mean small in size relatively to alumni base does not mean less work, right? I'm still always thinking about scale. I'm still always thinking about orchestration and how all of these pieces work together so that we can be greater than the sum of our parts. So I'm thinking about capacity, data literacy, operational excellence, connecting the dots, integration. That's really the overarching theme. And how technology, inclusive of AI, can help us be better informed, make better decisions, gain efficiencies, drive outcomes in the service of relationship building. So if we're in the world of philanthropy, we have to understand people's affinities, ways that they're engaging, ways that they want to be connected with and invited to give back and pay it forward. And we are, as nonprofits, there's over what, 1.6 or 1.7 million nonprofits registered in the US and growing. We are, with the consumerization of IT and these experiences, people order stuff on Amazon and they have an expectation that as a constituent, a consumer, a client, a customer, that their identity is understood, where their preferences, when they're giving us feedback, is understood. So the challenge is really how we can use these tools to create better relationships and show up for our constituencies in ways that resonate with them. Does that make sense? We could call it customer intimacy or this kind of other
Look,
language prompt,
probably
but.
the amount of data that Amazon knows about us relative to what Pomona College knows about its constituents is a fraction. It's a fraction. I mean, you have breadcrumbs that people leave throughout their life from when they started at the institution, what they were interested in while they were there, how they've been engaged since. The specific fund designations they've supported, the specific titles and the themes of the events that they've attended, the volunteer work that they've done. That is such a rich set of data that Amazon will never know about us, at least not in their current iteration. However, they have been able to, clearly lead the way as it relates to taking the breadcrumbs we're leaving by way of our digital footprint and converting that into better customer experiences. So they're starting with way less, they're turning it into way more, and that presents a big opportunity for our sector. And obviously we're super excited about at Evertrue about the ability for generative AI to help us synthesize that data that historically either wasn't synthesized at all or it was manually done by way of throwing bodies at the problem through, you know, through very manual time intensive research efforts, for example. So synthesizing the data, converting that better synthesis and understanding of who you are, who I am, into better outreach that feels more personalized, whether it's seeking a visit or following up on a gift that just came in, and, you know, not removing the human element through AI, but in fact, elevating the opportunity for people to spend more time on the human to human connection versus the manual tedious work that I think has held people back.
Absolutely. And the ability of an institution to separate the signal from the noise is a competitive advantage. And so I'm really inspired and energized around, you know, research and evidence-based approaches that can lead to these successful outcomes, these partnerships, but matchmaking, right? Taking the breadcrumbs and synthesizing and figuring out what is the signal here? What are we seeing here in ways that honor and are true to, there's fidelity to the constituents' expressions, preferences, wishes, intents, desires. You know, philanthropy, we can make inferences about interests and behavioral profiles, but sometimes we make a lot of assumptions about things and people change. You know, when you're 20, 30, 40, 50 years old, and then go along this life path, things unfold, interests. Just because you studied one discipline in undergrad, that doesn't necessarily turn into your career, but you could still have an interest in it. And for those with the inclination and the propensity and the engagement markers to then support an institution, how can we, again, matchmake the needs of the institution and these opportunities for investment in ways that are transformative and really meaningful? I really think that philanthropy helps people create and find meaning in their life. It's so powerful to help another person. When you give back, that intrinsic, I encourage everybody who's listening on this call, go out there and support an organization that means something to you. Dogs, music, whatever it is, there's this virtuous cycle. When you create access and opportunity for others, everything good that's ever come in my career is because I've opened a door, helped someone else. And there's just this law of reciprocity, whatever you want to call it.
Yeah,
I don't ever regret teaching, taking the time, being patient, being generous with others, because, and I'm so grateful. You know, I'm in this position, this leadership position, and it's all about team building, helping people get unlocked, helping people in their hierarchy of needs unlock their highest level of contribution, personally or professionally, whatever that may look like. And so, you know, you can say I'm an AVP of Advancement Operations. I'm just a curious person who is a problem solver, and I'm very action oriented, but I love data. I will geek out. We could have a whole session on large language models, because I studied formally natural language processing in graduate school, and to see the technology catching up, it's a dream come true, and endless possibilities. And with generative AI and LLMs in particular, we're always trying to synthesize information and understand what someone looks like and what they are interested in. We now have tools that can accelerate this.
Yeah. No, I mean, look, this is, I think, the third big wave that we've been a part of at Evertrue. The first was really social platforms and the opportunity for people to connect with each other and with brands they care about, including colleges, revealed so much potential, new signals for affinity, engagement, interests, et cetera. The second was mobile, and that was really almost in concert with social, where you could all of a sudden now dream up user experiences that before would have been impossible, right? And we've all got a whole host of those apps on our phone now, and we're excited that, you know, Evertrue's been able to be the advancement version of all of that. And now I think Gen AI is sort of the next one that also, by the way, builds so beautifully on both mobile and on social, because a lot of that data that we've been harnessing for over 10 years has been hard to synthesize. And we didn't have all of the resources on our campuses or even at Evertrue to maybe make sense of it. And now Gen AI is giving us the ability to synthesize that history in ways that we just couldn't have dreamt of before. And the intersection with mobile, I think, is going to be transformational, because it's going to allow us to, for example, for that road warrior, remove friction that, you know, still holds people back from doing some of those tasks that, if it were just a little bit more streamlined with that intersection of voice and AI, you know, maybe it could be done walking out of the meeting instead of, you know, at their hotel that night or on the plane when they're, you know, getting back to hammering out those contact reports. So there's so much potential. When you think about the CRM, you know, conversion, you said the word ecosystem before, you know, we talk about the advancement tech stack of the future. Like, what do you need from the vendor community? Like, what do you wish we and the other vendors in this sector did better as you think about 24, 25?
I see a lot of tools that are, back in my day, we would call it middleware, that, okay, you have an API key, you can connect and you can do some transfer, trying to work towards integration. But things even like event management, for a modern shop, and I've worked at large public and private research institutions, and now I'm at a private liberal arts college, I see a lot of struggle at that intersectional piece of, okay, we have our constituents of interest, or, you know, our donor database. We want to invite people to an event. The number of hoops, the number of add-ons, the number of a lot of overhead and the complexity to get these pieces fit together. Sometimes it's retrofitting, is a real struggle. And there's a lot of time and energy and resources spent on trying to get these things connected, the piping, if you will. So I think that the in this evolving ecosystem, the vendors that can make true plug and play easier, that we move more in a ubiquitous way that is multi-platform. Some of it is our symptoms of older tooling and infrastructure that make assumptions. You know, if you're working in a CRM that's 30 years old or homegrown, it wasn't, some of this stuff was created before APIs even existed. And so user experience, ease of use, the struggle point still remains. You have your home base, you have in your ecosystem another moving part to send out an invite, and then there's a representation, and you still need a key, form key or something to point and link that together. Oh, then Zoom and the pandemic, and then there, okay, is there an API that we can connect Zoom back into at these points so we can understand who's attending what? Because in advancement, if we know who's in the room and who's attending what, all of those signals of engagement, that's important for us to know in these kind of experiments to see what's resonating with people. And it seems awful, still awfully difficult with as much advanced and technology ground that we're making, advancing the grounds in technology. I still see a disproportionate struggle to get these systems to talk to each other. The other thing I would say in the line of AI, the ethical concerns and differential privacy, I think some of the security underpinnings and assumptions and the data models, I think privacy will become increasingly important navigating the regulatory environments, local, state, national, and international policies and laws. So topic for another time, but I'd say vendors having solutions that are sensitive to and solution-oriented and can navigate, help practitioners navigating those spaces great, because people are trying to do the programmatic stuff, and it's a lot of work to just get the systems, the zeros and ones, to harmonize. And I see some sacrifices being made on the constituent experience because the tooling, oh, sorry, this doesn't talk. Oh, sorry. Oh, you don't have that version. This doesn't work. And so you're left together with a lot of bubble gum and duct tape and hope.
Yeah. Yeah,
it's a long-winded way answer to say this is integration, but it's still painful.
What you're highlighting, though, is in the end, you're talking about the intersection of engagement, discovery, and relationship building, right? How can we cast a broad net, invite a lot of people into the tent, but based on signals that relate to those individuals, if they show up, we've got to have more action-oriented feedback or follow-up that is aligned with the potential of a given individual, right? So it's everybody needs to be included, everybody needs to be stewarded, but there need to be different shades that map to the individual capacity, for example. And I think that's where just the disconnect between alumni relations and fundraising, even post CRM conversions, can still exist. And it's like alumni engagement should be the number one source of pipeline generation for the fundraising team. Seems logical to me. I think more and more people are agreeing with that, but there's still a lot of people that if they heard that sentence, that alumni engagement should be the largest source of pipeline generation for the frontline team, it would just sound foreign. And I think that's where we've got to not only attack it from a systems and pipes perspective, but that strategically people even agree with that statement.
Yes, and the nuance, all the nuance there, because I see a lot of all or nothing thinking sometimes with the data. So I'd say the future is going to be very nuanced in even reimagining what is a constituent record and what is need to know and the temporal considerations. Is the data model federated? How modular is the system? Can these small tools, you know, as a Unix systems programmer way back in the day, I learned early on small little helpful tools that can chain and pipe integrate to one another is a very powerful paradigm, because then you can creatively and innovatively kind of mix and match and bring things together. But the interface, you'd be surprised when I talk to other people in their systems, they're like, yeah, we still have five different tools to try and do event management, and we're trying to get it into the marketing effort, but figuring out who attended at the event, and it's like having there's a lot of disparity and lack of integration with these tools. And as a language and a programmer by training, I think this is a critical area for us to solve, because it's a barrier to really advancing and putting the technology in the fundraiser's hands.
All right, Roger, we got to wrap. So let me just ask you, are you hiring? Maybe somebody will send you an email for a filler visit next time they're in California.
Yes, I'm excited. We have a director of CRM strategy and administration role open. And we have an associate director of prospect research. So big shout out to my amazing dream team. So we have Dr. Shalinda Martin, who's our senior director of advancement services, Lucy Takahashi, our director of annual giving, Derek Fang, who is our director of research, relationship management analytics, and last but not least, Jennifer Dunn-Greenspan, who's our director of stewardship. So we are open, listening, and we want curious, open-minded, lifelong learners to come join us to help us meet our mission.
Well, you should all send Roger a note that aligns with who you are. We start with hola or something that might catch attention. I've got about 10 minutes, Roger, before my next commitment. I would like your number one recommendation for a classical music piece that I should listen to the next 9 minutes.
Oh, wow. Okay. I'm going to suggest that you pull up Clair de Lune by Debussy. It's a very meditative piece. Debussy was quite impressionistic, but I'm a romantic at heart, so I think Debussy, you can't go wrong with Clair de Lune.
All right, with that, I'm pulling up Clair de Lune. Dang it. I don't know if it will pick up in the audio. I'm confident our producer, Lillian, will figure out a way to get it in there. And I have to say thank you, Roger. I really appreciate your time and would encourage everybody to reach out and connect with Roger on LinkedIn or track him down on email. But I look forward to continuing to get to know you, Roger. We're clearly aligned in some of the ways that we hope the industry continues to advance. And and you know, hoping to work on that together. So best wishes. Have a great start to 2024, and take care, everybody. With that, closing today's episode with Roger Devine, Assistant Vice President for Advancement Operations at FMI.